From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour, I talk with Eric Kumide-Frixas, a federally certified interpreter who translated at the federal hearings in Waterloo after the 2008 immigration raid at Agriprocessors, Inc. in Postville. He'll give us his view of the largest single-site immigration raid in U.S. history and how it changed the lives of innumerable people. Then in our second half hour, New York Times bestselling author Steve Roberts. He'll tell us about his new book with contemporary stories of immigration. It's called From Every End of This Earth, 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America. That's all coming up this hour. First, let's check the news. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. The immigration debate has been placed on the back burner as of late, as politicians in Washington focus on health care and the economy. Yet rallies continue across the country by immigration reform advocates pushing for reform in 2010. Today we examine the immigration experience from two perspectives. In the second half of our program, I'll talk with New York Times bestselling author Steve Roberts. This award-winning journalist and commentator says he's fascinated by his grandparents' migration to America from the Old World nearly 100 years ago. His latest book, From Every End of This Earth, 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America, explores the contemporary immigrant experience and shares the accounts and voices of 13 families who are following in the footsteps of his ancestors. But first, a conversation with Eric Kumide-Frixas, a federally certified interpreter who translated at the federal hearings in Waterloo after the 2008 immigration raid at Agriprocessors in Postville. Kumide-Frixas will recount his experiences as a translator next week with a number of stops across Iowa, including Clinton, Cedar Falls, Iowa City, and Cedar Rapids. I spoke with Eric Kumide-Frixas yesterday and began by asking him to talk about his role as an interpreter in the immigration raid in Postville.
Interpreters are involved in every area of the process. We get to meet with either side. We help either side. So we get to see things that the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, or the judges never get to see because they only have one aspect that they're involved in. I was not present at the raid. I was contracted a month before together with other 25 interpreters, and it was very secretive. We were told it was a continuity of operation exercise, and that's all we were told. And when we got there is to the National Cattle Congress the morning to start the hearings. That's when they told us there had been a raid the day before, and the clerk of court said they have about 400 people detained here, and we're going to be conducting arraignments until late every day for the next few days.
Okay, so that's when you enter the picture during the arraignment at the National Dairy Cattle Congress grounds in Waterloo. On that day of the arraignment, what happened? What did you experience?
Well, we had a quick tour of the premises, you know, with guards following us, and we kind of got to see the grounds, and there was an evacuation protocol in place in case there was some kind of a riot and so on and so forth. So all of these measures that, you know, we just felt that, you know, wow, what are we dealing here with? And then when they started calling the people, you know, it was very evident that, you know, were just, you know, peasants, 80% of them Guatemalans, Mayans. You know, they were all in chains, and they were brought in 10 by 10 in this kind of chain gang, and they were prosecuted 10 at a time. This is very incongruous. I've never seen anything like this, and I said, well, you know, let's see what's going on. So then they start arraigning them, and they start telling them, well, you have the presumption of innocence, but you don't have, you're not going to have a bail hearing because there's an immigration detainer underneath the criminal complaint. So, you know, you're not, you know, bail is moot, so you don't have a right to a bail hearing. So all of these rights that are afforded to even common criminals were denied to these people. And then the charges came forth, and they were being charged with aggravated identity theft.
What does that mean in legal terms, aggravated identity theft?
Well, it means basically that it's an aggravated felony. The statute says knowingly uses the form of identification of another person during the commission of a crime. So there are a couple of problems there. Working is not a crime, so they were not using this during the commission of a crime.
But being in the country illegally is a crime.
Well, it is a civil misdemeanor, and the penalty for that is deportation. It's not incarceration. We kept telling them, you know, you're being charged with identity theft. And I said, you know, I didn't steal anything. I bought these documents. I was using my own name. And we would ask them, well, what is this number over here, pointing to the Social Security number? And they would say, I don't know. Who put it there? I said, at the plant. They filled it out, you know, because I don't know how to read and write Spanish, let alone English. So, they were just told me that I needed documents when I first showed up. And then, you know, somebody pointed me over to this house, and they took my picture. I gave them money, or I owed them money and paid them later from their wages. And then came back, and they gave me the papers, and I took them to a plant, and they put me to work. Mm-hmm. So it was the question of knowingly is a crucial part of the statute of identity theft. And as a matter of fact, after Postville, you know, the legal scandal was such that the charge went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, on May 4th, 2009, ruled unanimously, 9-0, to disallow the use of identity theft charges against unknowing migrants or unknowing people. Mm-hmm. In order for it to be real identity theft, you have to know that you have the identity of somebody else.
So they were each offered a plea agreement in exchange for a guilty plea. They would be deported?
No, they would be sent to jail as felons and then deported after they got out of jail. Because, you know, the whole system now, at least up until then, you know, things have changed since Postville because of the legal scandal. In no small part to the fact that, you know, I gave the account of what happened from the inside so that the legal community could scrutinize it, as it should be in a democracy. So things have changed somewhat since then. Certainly not enough, but the trend has been in the last several years, at least since 2003, when Homeland Security was created to criminalize migrants. To come into the country illegally is a civil misdemeanor. It's not a federal felony. It's not even a federal misdemeanor. That was the way it was done. And to begin with, you know, there was no presumption of innocence because I felt like a fool interpreting those words to people who were in chains, who had been mistreated, who had been denied as much as a bail hearing, who had been forced to give up their right to be indicted by a grand jury, and several other items in the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution.
If you just joined us, my guest is Eric Kamide-Fraixas. He is a federally certified interpreter who translated at the federal hearings in Waterloo at the National Dairy Cattle Congress grounds after the raid in Postville. If you had to pick out a moment in your interpreter's work during this whole process that really stands out as representing what you see as the egregious wrongs that were carried out in this process, can you point to a single case, a single moment, either at the arraignment or in these meetings with defense attorneys or the court appearance that you would like to relay?
Absolutely. The moment of reckoning for me, I mean, there were several moments, but there was one moment that stands out in my mind. We were interviewing the prisoners in jail. This was at the Newton State Penitentiary. After they were arraigned, they were sent to jails all over Iowa, wherever there was space, away from family, away from the community support, away from lawyers even. And we had to basically go all through Iowa to find them. So we went on a Sunday, and we finally were able to get into the prison, and we started interviewing them one by one. When I say we, there was an attorney, and there was another interpreter and me working in team. We always work in teams to have, like, relays. And so we started interviewing this particular man who basically the first interview took 3 hours, and he was just sobbing, crying. He was completely broken. He had failed his family. He was worried sick about his children, how they were going to survive. And we were trying to make him understand the plea agreement, which was so coercive that it unfortunately put the attorneys and the interpreters in the position of being government agents. You know, we were the bearers of bad news. So, you know, the defendants did not trust their own lawyers. They saw us, the lawyers and the interpreters, as part of the system that was abusing them. So at one moment, after, you know, a couple of hours into the interview, this man said, "I know all you're doing is doing your jobs, and your job is to, you know, in doing your jobs in order to feed your families, and that job is to keep me from doing my job to feed mine." So, you know, the attorney was taken aback, and she looked at me and just swallowed hard, and we had to say, you know, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right.
You said that.
I said to myself, he's absolutely right.
You didn't say that out loud.
No. During the whole proceeding, I'm an interpreter, completely impartial. I do not make comments. I just do my job. Mm-hmm. After the cases were closed, I wrote a full report on what I had seen, and I sent it to a federal judge, and I sent it to my interpreter colleagues. But that was after the case was already closed. And because during the proceedings themselves, I have to be absolutely impartial, absolutely confidential, and have no reaction. So I absolutely did my job to the letter, the way I always do. All the interpreters did. That's part of our code of ethics. After the case is closed, my contract is no longer ongoing, and at that point, I have a duty as a citizen, I have a duty as an American, to bring this to the public eye.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Eric Kamide-Frakesis, a federally certified interpreter who translated at the hearings in Waterloo after the 2008 immigration raid in Postville. Let's get back to my interview with Eric Kamide-Frakesis, the interpreter who translated at the federal hearings in Waterloo. That was following the 2008 immigration raid at agriprocessors in Postville.
Have you had any feedback, fallout, reaction from ICE, from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division of the Department of Homeland Security?
I have had absolutely no fallout from it, aside from the fact that I've received several awards nationally and internationally. I've received thousands of letters of support from Americans all over the country, many of them from Postville, citizens of Postville. I have absolutely nothing to regret. On the contrary, as I continue to investigate and find out more about the egregiousness of this whole affair and how it reflects a national trend and the fact that this was a pilot operation that would have been repeated, would have become the norm all over the country, I am more affirmed in the fact that I believe I've done the federal court, which I'm very proud to have worked for so many years, a great service. I believe I've done a great service to our country.
We want to let our listeners know that we here at Iowa Public Radio reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Iowa's Northern District the one handled that handled this case, asked them to react to the allegations that you've made about this process, and they declined to issue a statement. Let me play a bit of a devil's advocate here. Some people listening may be thinking, all right, these are people illegally in the country. They broke the law. They have now been deported. There was a time when they were interrogated, when it was investigated. This is post-9/11 America, after all. And they were locked up for a certain time. They were deported. Why should we be so concerned about some flaws in this process?
Well, we're not talking about flaws. We're talking about a breakdown of our justice system. If you allow this to happen to any group of people, in this case, Guatemalans mostly, and some Mexican immigrants, migrant workers, basically. These are displaced people. These are vulnerable populations. But regardless of who they are, if we allow this to happen to one particular group, what is going to keep it from happening to another group? You know, there are some sacred principles in our Constitution. The Bill of Rights is nothing to be played around with. And you can invoke 9/11, but the bottom line is that the moment we start terrorizing our own communities, we are doing the terrorist work for them. That means that 9/11 was a success because we've internalized fear and we've allowed it to rule our domestic policy, our foreign policy, and our immigration policy.
How do you see this Postville chapter, this raid, and the process that you were involved in fitting into the larger immigration debate in this country?
Well, I'll tell you, the Postville case was an inflection point in our immigration debate because it made us realize, yes, we can go overboard in the way the laws are interpreted and applied.
So you think this is perhaps the point where the pendulum had swung quite a ways to an extreme side?
Yes, absolutely. This was unheard of in American history, in American legal history. Not to mention the case of the federal interventionism in a local community that, you know, has been virtually destroyed. That's also another issue. But so that you understand very easily what happened after Postville is that there was another raid in Laurel, Mississippi. It was even larger, 595 people arrested. Only 8 were criminalized, were charged criminally. The rest were put over for deportation. The people who were arrested in Postville were begging to be deported. They said, oh, my family, my children are back in Guatemala or Mexico. Please deport me. I need to feed them. Every day that I don't work, every week I don't work, is a week that my children don't eat. So it's very easy for Americans who have a certain standard of living to say, oh, so they spent 5 months in jail. Well, you know, what about the impact on their families? You know, these people live in some of the poorest communities in the Western Hemisphere.
Are you saying that based on the reaction, the two different ways these raids were approached, the Postville one and the latter one, that if not in word, indeed, the federal authorities learned from it?
They realized they couldn't get away with another Postville. But more importantly, you know, I started working in speaking to trade unions, to interfaith groups, to several organizations around the country, and asking them for resolutions demanding a moratorium on raids. And I sent them to Congress, and we actually had resolutions from the Hispanic caucus in Congress and from the Hispanic and Jewish members of Congress. And they were signed, among other people, by Rahm Emanuel, who today is President Obama's chief of staff, demanding a moratorium on raids until we fix our broken immigration system. It's irresponsible to continue that kind of raiding when everybody agrees that our immigration law system is broken. First, fix the system. Then you can do enforcement that we can be proud of as Americans. So the last of these worksite raids happened in February 28, 2009 in Washington State. It was a small raid, 29 people arrested. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano didn't know anything about the raid and was informed after the fact, and she was very upset. She said, well, you know, how can this go on without me? I'm the boss, without me knowing.
So the Obama administration is only a few weeks in office at the time that last raid took place. So you see a marked difference in the way this is being handled, or the changes that have been made from the transition from the President Bush era to the Obama era.
Well, yes and no. The big high-profile raids have stopped, but what are we going to do with this force, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, with the 20,000 agents? They're not going to sit around twiddling their thumbs. So what they did is they stepped up home raids, and they have become incredibly abusive. And now we're getting into an issue not of constitutional rights, but of human rights. They've become very abusive all over the country. So they've stepped up their home raid, and the deportations, the total arrest, incarceration, and deportation has increased from 350,000 in 2008 to 380,000 in 2009, and that has been an increasing trend that they have just skyrocketed since 2006.
Mr. Kumaid Fraxas, I want to end by asking you, you've stepped forward to speak out, speaking out at the University of Northern Iowa and in Iowa. What do you hope to achieve by speaking out?
Well, I'll tell you, I was invited by Sister Mary McCauley from Postville, and she and the organizers decided to call this, I entitled it Immigrant Rights and American Values, because I'm really more interested in American values than immigrant rights. I'm interested in immigrant rights to the extent that it reflects our values as a nation. And those are values that I'm not willing to compromise on, and I don't think that most Americans are willing to compromise on. Now, they subtitled it Seeing with New Eyes. And I think that's a very telling title, because to me, this was such an eye-opener, this Postville case. It was a life-changing experience. And I think it was almost like Paul on the road to Damascus. He was struck by lightning, went blind, and then the scales fell off his eyes because he would persecute Christians. And now he saw with new eyes. I can relate to that biblical story because that was, you know, it's not that I was persecuting anybody, but it was such an eye-opener and such a life-changing event. And that's what I'm trying to, the message that I'm trying to get across. I think that our nation needs to see with new eyes. And I definitely think that Postville is on the road to Damascus.
Thank you very much, Eric Kumaid Fraxas. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
A conversation I had yesterday with Eric Kumaid Fraxas, a federally certified interpreter who translated at the federal hearings in Waterloo after the 2008 immigration raid at agriprocessors in Postville. Kumaid Fraxas will recount his experiences as a translator next week with a number of stops across Iowa. Coming up next on The Exchange, my conversation with Steve Roberts, the award-winning journalist and commentator, visits Des Moines next week to talk about his latest book, From Every End of This Earth, 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America. That's when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Steve Roberts is a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning journalist. He traced the story of his own family's journey to the New World 100 years ago in My Father's Houses. He's coming to Des Moines next week to talk about his latest book, From Every End of This Earth, 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America. In it, he examines the modern-day stories of immigrant families. I spoke with Steve Roberts recently and asked if the current immigration debate was one reason for writing the book now.
Certainly, this is an issue that's on the minds of a lot of people. Now, Barack Obama talked about it in his inaugural address. In fact, the title of this book, From Every End of This Earth, comes from Obama's inaugural, where he said, our patchwork nation is a strength, not a weakness. Of course, he embodies this story, too, and that was certainly part of it. His own journey with a African father, he, I think, in his bones, understands and reflects that journey that so many Americans have made. And then I was teaching a writing course at George Washington University, and I started getting these wonderful stories from my own students of their own families. And I realized that the power and the immediacy and the vibrancy of the immigrant story is just as alive and as powerful today as it was 100 years ago when my grandparents made this journey. So that was certainly the other motive. And in fact, this book is dedicated to my students at GW who were such an inspiration for me.
Now, are there broad ways in looking at these 13 profiles that you can say the experience of an immigrant coming to America is different in the 21st century than in former times, the 20th or the 19th centuries?
There are some things about immigration that never change. There's a woman in this book from Afghanistan who says, you want to understand how I feel about Afghanistan, read a poem that was written by a 13th century mystic named Rumi, who wrote in Farsi. And Rumi writes that if in a poem called The Song of the Reed, if you pluck a reed from the reed bed and you blow through it, it makes a particularly mournful and lonely sound. And that sound, he writes, is the pain of separation that the reed feels from having been plucked out of the bed. And Maria Z said, look, I fled Afghanistan in terror from the communists. I was happy to leave, but I still feel like that reed plucked from the bed. I still feel that pain of separation Rumi writes about. So that never changes. I mean, after all, he wrote in the 13th century, so it's a long time ago.
Right, right. That surprises me because we have airplanes that go around the world in hours, and you would think, but many of the immigrants that you interviewed are ones who actually, just like Irish immigrants ages ago, would have had a wake and would have said, I know I'm not coming back.
Well, it's true because no matter how much you want to leave, no matter if you flee the Tsar's army in terror, as my grandfathers did almost 100 years ago, you still leave something behind. You leave the graves of your ancestors. The food never tastes the same anywhere else. The air never smells the same anywhere else as it does at home. But you asked about modern immigration, and at least three things that are really strikingly different. One is the feminization of immigration, as it's been called by one sociologist. Historically, immigration was largely a male enterprise. Sure, women came, but often they had to come under the protection of a man. The economic and cultural shibboleths were so strong that they needed an uncle or a brother or a father to protect them and support them. That's not true today. And many of the jobs that are being created in our service economy are actually more suited to women than to men. The old traditions of strong, maybe not very well-educated immigrant men, the Chinese who built the railroads, or the Italians who mined slate in Pennsylvania, or the Irish who built the Erie Canal in New York. Today, you have women from the Philippines and from Jamaica and from Africa and Ethiopia, and they are very well suited to jobs in the service economy, particularly in healthcare. My mother was recently in the hospital, and as I sat with her in the intensive care unit here in suburban Washington, every single person, everyone who took care of my mother was a foreign-born woman of color. If you take them out of the hospital, you take foreign-born women of color out of the hospital here in Maryland or in Des Moines or anywhere else in America, those hospitals would collapse overnight. And so there is the possibilities, there's the economic opportunities for women, plus the decline of the cultural bars or bans that said single women can't travel alone. So that's one thing that's changed markedly. A second thing that's changed is communications. My grandfather, Avram Rogovsky, came from Russia in 1914. He was out of touch with his own sister back in Moscow for 50 years. Today I have a student from Brazil. Her brother got married to another Brazilian. The woman's family couldn't come to America for the wedding, couldn't get visas. My student in her bridesmaid's dress took a laptop and a digital camera to the wedding, took all these photos of the wedding, put them up on the web, and the bride's family, sitting back in a rural village in Brazil, watched the wedding in real time on the slideshow that my student put up on the web.
That's amazing. It reminds me, too, my wife is an immigrant from Germany. This year, for the first time, we used Skype over the internet. We used video real time to open Christmas presents together.
That's a great example of exactly what I'm talking about, a great example. And there's a third dimension of this that's really changed. When I was growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, there were Italian families who imported cheese or olive oil from the old country. There were probably Danish families in Iowa who did, ported blue cheese as well. But today, there's been a huge growth of international trade, particularly with Asia. And the immigrants have enormous advantages in negotiating that trade. They know the language often. They understand the cultural traditions. They might have family or tribal connections. There's a family in my book from China. The Chan family fled the communists a generation ago in terror. They never looked back, settled in Hong Kong. Their son came to college in San Francisco. He was an accountant in the Bay Area when China first opened its trade to the West. One thing led to another, and today Tom Chan spends 2 weeks a month back in China, where he is a major exporter or importer in the United States of fireworks made in China. In one generation, his family went from fleeing the communists in terror to spending 2 weeks a month back in China doing business, and that's a big change.
We talk about things that have changed between the contemporary immigrants and previous generations. 9/11 has to play a role there, doesn't it? As a milestone, as a change factor.
In two ways, of course, it has caused a tightening of security considerations, and it has made it harder for some immigrants, both legal and undocumented, to make their way to America. Even if you have a legal right to emigrate through family connections, it can sometimes take as long as 10 years, say, for a brother and sister to reunite in America. The process has been slowed way down. The other thing, of course, is that there is more suspicion aimed at Muslim immigrants. And this is nothing new. Throughout our entire 200-year history, there have been spasms of resentment. And as much as we love to cherish our own foreign-born ancestors and tear up at the sight of the Statue of Liberty, the truth is, it's just as American to resent immigration and to and reject the newcomers. It happened in 1798 when the Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, and they were trying to keep out the French. And in 1840, the Know-Nothing Party wanted to keep out the Irish and German Catholics. And in the 1920s, it was trying to keep out the Italians, the anti-Italian craze that climaxed with the Sacco and Vanzetti trial. And then you had the Japanese who were interned in California in the 1940s. And today, in the post-9/11 world, there has been a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment. And I wanted in this book to see the profile one family, at least one, that saw the world through the eyes of a post-11 Muslim family. And I found three sisters who were born in Burma and came to California very young and grew up as Muslims in California. And they have faced some difficulties. Right after 9/11, they wear hijab, the traditional Muslim headscarf, and their mother asked them to take it off because she was so worried that they would face discrimination. And they said, no, we're in America, and that means we have the right and the ability to express ourselves. And so they had, and their mother was so worried about them, so they went to Target, and the three sisters bought these long-sleeved white sweaters with hoods. And they promised their mom that they would wear the hood over their hijab so people couldn't see that they were actually Muslims. But they could still wear the hijab. Well, there's a perfect example of how people sort of adjust. But one of these sisters said to me once, and she has faced discrimination. She lives in Minnesota now, and she said, I was applying to graduate school. All three of these Muslim women, by the way, are in graduate school. And she said, I applied for a graduate degree in social work, and they asked me to define myself. I put down, I'm an immigrant. I'm a Muslim. I'm my mother's daughter, and I'm a strong woman of color. And then she paused and said, and I'm a California chick.
You conducted a number of interviews for this book. You interviewed for every one of these profiles, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I at least 10 or 12 hours with each one of these families on tape.
Did you have a poignant or a surprising moment in the interview that you'd like to share?
Well, there were many, but one of my favorites involved the Indian family, Asis and Indira Banerjee. They live outside of Cleveland. Some of these families struggled to get to America and fled persecution, fled civil war in Africa. Asis got on a plane in New Delhi and came to Case Western for graduate school in chemistry. There was absolutely nothing dramatic or heroic about his coming here, but he represents this very important dimension of modern immigration, which is how critical immigrants often are to creation of jobs. And he has a factory that he built in suburban Cleveland, employs 40 or 50 people building high-tech plastics. But no matter how modern these immigrant families often are, the moment when the cultural clash becomes greatest, when the tension between the old world and the new world really crystallize, is when their children get married. Mm. Because those are the moments when they make a definitive choice. Do I sign up with the old tribe or do I do something different?
A question of identity.
Of course it is. It's identity not just for the children, but of course of who their grandchildren are going to be. So it's a very poignant moment. And one day I was sitting in the Banerjee house in suburban Cleveland, and Indira was talking to one of her daughters, Piali, who's a very beautiful and very rebellious child. And so this following conversation ensued. Mother, so how come you never bring home any nice Indian boys? Daughter, I haven't met any nice Indian boys. Mother, you're not looking hard enough. Daughter, I am looking. I haven't met any. Mother, go on the internet. Your cousin found a nice Indian boy on the internet. Now, if you took the word Indian and replaced it with Honduran or Japanese or Vietnamese or Polish, that story, that conversation between the immigrant mother and the American daughter could have been any single ethnic group, any single religion. And that moment when I just sat there and listened to the two women talking to each other was one of my favorite moments, because it was so genuine, and but also it transcended ethnicity. There was something so perfectly human, because I don't care what your ethnic group, the relationship between mother and daughter is such a profoundly human one that you can change the ethnic name and it's almost always the same.
What else did you find out about the pressure to assimilate, even also comparing it to your grandparents? Has that changed over time when we look at these contemporary immigrants, that, or does it really depend on the culture and the family, the degree to which they want to assimilate?
I think that there's no real formula. There are often great pressures to assimilate. There are also great pressures to maintain ties to the tribe. Different children can react in different ways. The Chan family I mentioned, Chinese family, the older brother, Herbert Chan, got a graduate degree and was working in business in California. His father got sick. The family called, and Herbert, the last thing in the world really at that point in his life was he wanted to come home and run the family business. But the family called, and he just said to me, family first. I knew what I had to do. There was simply no question. I had to go home, run the business. He dates a Chinese woman. He lives in the same house his parents do. He walks through San Francisco's Chinatown many days and sees his grandmother, who does not speak English. His younger brother, Arthur, comes to Georgetown on the East Coast to college. He defines his Chinese-ness in a quite different way. He says, I decided that I was a person of color and that I was identified with a broader community of people of color at Georgetown. So he joined a Hispanic dance troupe. Hmm. Now, try to explain to your Chinese grandmother that your expression of traditions is joining a Hispanic dance troupe. That's a tough one. But he wants to be a filmmaker. Well, one son says, I have to be true to my family, and I came home. And the other son said, I have to be true to myself, and he left home. And these are two brothers 2 years apart, taking very different routes, but both very American ones.
Steve, are there
immigrant myths you found that you feel need to be busted?
Yes. Good question. And the most prominent one is that the streets are paved with gold. They're not. Never have been. And the families in my book who did not succeed, and there are some, I mean, many of these are wonderful stories of hard work and resilience and triumph, but some of them have struggled. And the ones who have struggled most are the ones who thought it would be easy. Obama himself, you know, has talked about this, how it's not for the faint-hearted, you know. This family from Burma, I mentioned the Muslim family, the father had always wanted to come to America. He was desperate to come, wanted the freedom. Burma was a repressive police state. And he yearned for the freedoms of America. And as soon as he got here, the very freedoms that he yearned for became a threat. He was terrified. They were a threat to his position in the family. They were a threat to tribal values. They were a threat, he thought, to his three daughters' virtue. And he brought them up, as one daughter said, bubble-wrapped. And he never learned English, in part because he banned English from the house, because he saw it as an insidious influence, a modern influence on his daughters. The result is he never learned English and was never able to get a good job. And his daughter said to me, you know, he suffered from this idea that it would be easy. And finally, late in his working life, just recently, he's been able to secure a reasonably good job in an export-import company where he can spend the day speaking in Urdu, one of the many languages he speaks, but he's never learned English very well.
Right.
So that's a very good example of a myth.
So it is the generation that comes to America that sacrifices itself because they don't seem to have the best life, or do they?
They all sacrifice in one way or another. In fact, this phrase, the sacrifice generation, is a wonderful phrase. And there's a woman from Vietnam in this book. She and her husband struggled for years and years to escape from Vietnam after the communist takeover. He had been a naval officer in the old regime, and he knew from the day the communists took over there was no future for him and his family in Vietnam. But it took them 6 years, most of which they spent in jail because they kept trying to escape, kept getting arrested. She told me the story of when they finally got free, they finally found a boat that was seaworthy enough to get them outside the coastal waters of Vietnam, but then the engine conked out. And they were floating aimlessly. Water was gone. They were close to starvation and close to dehydration for their little kids. And she said to me, you know, I could only figure out one thing left to do to feed my children. I would cut my wrist and feed my children my blood. And she said, we are the sacrifice generation. Now, that's a particularly poignant and dramatic example. But every person who makes that journey, whether it's on the South China Sea or getting on a plane and just flying to Cleveland, every immigrant sacrifices something because they're never fully at home in the new country, but they can't go home again either. And they're suspended between these worlds. And it's, if you say, well, what are they sacrificing for? You can sum that up in one word. It's only one word. And that word is children. Mm. And it's for their children that they make that sacrifice. And it's not till you get the first generation born in America where they feel fully American and fully at home here. Their parents never quite do.
Steve, to bring this full circle, we talked about the current immigration debate being mm-hmm. a reason that you brought out, you wrote this book. So what can a look back at the profiles of these 13 contemporary immigrant families add to the debate going on now in this country that would be valuable?
Well, I think there are two dimensions. One is economic. Every single study I've consulted and profiles in this book reinforce this, say that immigrants contribute far more to the American economy than they take away. Bill Gates goes to Congress every year pleading for more visas for foreign-born high-tech engineers and computer scientists. He says that fully one-third of the patents that Microsoft holds were created by the work of foreign-born engineers. One-third. Whether it's on that high-tech level, whether it's the Chinese family that runs a laundry in the neighborhood in Des Moines or the Pakistani family that runs a 7-Eleven, immigrants are job-creating engines, and they're absolutely critical to American prosperity. But the second thing is a less tangible but just as important idea, and that's the sense of cultural diversity, the energy, the vibrancy that these newcomers contribute. Let's remember who they are. They're very self-selected. They're the ones with the most dynamism, the most imagination. The dull ones, they're back in Vietnam. They're back in Poland. They never got on the boat. They never got on the plane. They never crossed that river. And it is the great genius of America that we are always renewed by these people. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the spasms of anti-immigrant feeling that is shown today against Hispanics and Muslims. The underlying assumption that you hear from the fulminators, from the Lou Dobbs of the world, is, and you've heard it for 200 years, the language is almost exactly the same from anybody who's resented immigration throughout our history. And that language says, America is now perfect, and any newcomers we allow in are going to degrade or corrupt the culture. And it's time to pull up the drawbridge. They profoundly misunderstand the very nature, the very essence of American culture and history, which is that we're never perfect. We're never finished. And if the know-nothings, as in the 1840s, had their way, your people, my people, and a whole lot of families listening to us right now would never have made it to America, and what a tragedy that would have been, because it would deprive this country of so much energy and so much creativity and so much dedication. And it's the cultural contribution as much as the economic contribution that I find so valuable.
A recent conversation I had with Steve Roberts. Roberts is speaking Monday at 6:30 at the Des Moines Public Library. His latest book is From Every End of This Earth, 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.